Amen.
Thank you, guys. Well, it's great to get together with you again as we continue, as we worship God and then get into His Word and look at what He has to teach us in the book of Joshua. Before I begin, though, I've been bombarded the last couple days by questions from people who are saying, well, the U.S. invading, with Israel invading, you know, Iran, is this biblical prophecy? Because there are people who are saying, this is what the Bible predicted, this is it, this is Ezekiel 38. Nonsense. That's ridiculous. In fact, Jesus said, you shouldn't listen to anybody that tells you this is when it's going to happen. Because He said, they're false prophets. Nobody knows the day or the hour. I don't even know, He said. But He said there's going to be lots of people who go, oh, there's wars, rumors of wars. Now, besides that, Ezekiel 38, which is what people are citing and saying, it predicts, you know, Iran. And Ezekiel 38 says that Russia, most likely Rosh, is going to invade Israel. And along with them are Persia, as well as Libya and Ethiopia, two North African nations. That's not happening. This is Israel and the U.S. attacking Iran. So if you somehow can twist Ezekiel 38 to say this is what it's talking about, I don't see it at all. Now, at the same time, I believe fully that every word of prophecy will one day be fulfilled. But I trust Jesus in saying, you can't just figure out what it is because that's none of your business. You have to keep living your life faithfully. But again, especially twisting scripture in order to act like, oh, I knew this was going to happen. That's sort of, I mean, it sells and then it lets people down. And then you've got to come up with a new lie to sell it again. So anyway, yeah, no, this is an interesting development. Who knows where it fits in the overall scope of history. But right now, the idea of Russia invading a country like Israel is preposterous. Russia has their hands full right now trying to beat a country that was a part of their country, the Ukraine. Understand, Russia has lost more, they have had more casualties in their war with the Ukraine than the U.S. has lost in our last 100 years of warfare. So their hands are full. I'm not thinking, okay, they're going to, no, just, it is what it is. Jesus is coming back. He can come back today. He doesn't need any war to trigger Him to come back. And I'd love it. If Jesus came back today, I'd be thrilled. Absolutely. But if He doesn't come back for another 100 years, Peter says He's delaying because He wants more people to get saved, because He isn't willing that any should perish, but all should come to repentance. And I was explaining to my grandkids last night, who were asking about this too, that, you know, I thought, when I was younger, I thought, Jesus is going to come back by 1981. And I said, if He had, you guys wouldn't exist. You wouldn't be with me in heaven forever. So that's my take on it anyway. Now let's turn to Joshua chapter 11. Now, these chapters that we're going to look at today, I'm going to move fairly quickly through this passage because, for the most part, we look at Joshua's chapter 11 and really for the next through at least chapter 21, and it seems really tedious because it's listing over and over again, here are the cities that Israel conquered. Here are the kings that Israel killed. Here are the places that they had to go. And it's like over and over again, listing names, listing all the kings, listing all of the areas. And for us, that seems like, ugh. I mean, and Justin and I, as we were looking at the book of Joshua, we're like, are we going to do this for the next 2 months? It's just like this stuff. I came up with the short end of the stick, and I'm like, let me knock out as many as I can today, and everyone will win as a result. But it is really important. In fact, these chapters, though they're pretty meaningless to us for a huge extent, at the same time, these meant a lot to Israel. In fact, these chapters that we're going to brush through today represented the fulfillment for Israel of everything that God had ever promised them for hundreds of years. It's like very specifically, God is doing what he said he would do, and he breaks it down where it's almost tedious to show, look, this is what I said I was going to do, and this is what I am doing. So for them, this is really important. Now, there are a few reasons why it seems irrelevant or tedious to us. For one thing, we are an individualistic culture, where they were a collectivist culture. A collectivist culture means my identity is in my family connections, and first of all, it has to do with land. Like, we don't even hardly have a sense of a homeland. Like, this is our place. But most of the world, for most of history, and certainly for Israel, it was like, you're going to get your piece of land. And, you know, even Solomon talked about, you get your land, and you plant your fields, and you get your vineyards, and you put your cattle in there, and then you build your house, and your family stays on that land, and then your kids will be on that land, and your grandkids will be on that land. That's the way most of society has thought and functioned during most of history. And it certainly, for them, that was the core of what God had promised them. So, because today we have a tendency to like, location, whatever. If I don't like it here, I'll try moving there. If I don't like it here, I'm going to go there. Yeah, my kids are scattered throughout the world and whatever. It's like, that's our culture, but that's why we don't understand. In a collectivist culture, it was like, we stay together, we sink roots deep, and this is our life, and this is going to be our life moving forward. So that's why for them, these things, these details mattered. For us, we tend to, they're not as big of a deal. Because, and you can argue whether they were better than off than we are, whether we've lost something significant, perhaps we have. But they also, as a collectivist culture, for the children of Israel and for all these other nations as well, your relatives mattered, your ancestors mattered, your history mattered. We are individualistic, so it's like, I know my parents' names. I think I know my grandparents' names. My great-grandparents, I have no idea, hardly anything about them, because we're individuals. I only know the people that I've had contact with. I don't have a great sense of my history. Now, the Mormons are helping with that, doing a lot of work on genealogies and stuff, but like, I have a relative who was the governor of California, Governor Rolfe. I know that, but what's my relation to him exactly? I haven't bothered really studying it or looking it up. And he ended up, having to withdraw from office in disgrace. So I'm like, I don't brag about, Governor Rolfe too much. But really, I'm like about what's going on now. That's what an individualistic culture does. But in a collectivist culture, and it's one of the reasons why going into these nations, it's like they said, you have to kill everyone. Because if you left anybody as a survivor, when they grow up, they're coming after you. That's the way a collectivist culture does. But in our culture, it's like, we don't look at it that way. So as a result, some of these things seem irrelevant to us. And then I think also you have the whole question of war, where our concept generally of war is, this is a horrible thing, and we should, we should never go to war. And there are people who think that the country should never have a war. But and war is a tragedy for sure. I would never want to minimize it. But at the same time, you have to understand, you would not exist, and you would not have a homeland, you would not have a place to sink your roots if somebody didn't kill somebody else in order for somebody to get that land. It's the way the world functions. And as much as you can say, Billie Eilish can say, we live on stolen land. Well, but the people who we supposedly stole it from somebody else. That's the way it's all. The land is, somebody has to be willing to fight to establish borders and to secure them. And so we see them doing this. And for us, it seems like, wow, that's kind of harsh. Because you deny like all of history in order to think, right now we can be pretty secure, and you know, we don't, because somebody else, lots of people, gave their lives so that we could exist as a nation. We wouldn't have the United States had we not battled the Brits, had we not battled the French, the Spanish. You know, it's like the people who were here before. It's like, no, this is what, for most of history, this is just a part of the reality. But we like living in our secure bubble and just pretending like that doesn't exist and warfare is unnecessary. If it weren't for warfare, you wouldn't be sitting here judging us for going to war because you wouldn't exist. So keep that in mind, the collectivist nature of most of the world's population and certainly of Israel, as we look at this, and let's just jump into this and see how far we can get. Chapter 11. Chapter 11 basically summarizes all of the conquests of Israel. In a lot of ways, the book could have ended with chapter 11 because it goes briefly and says, here's all the land that they conquered. And so, you know, lists all these different kings. And in verse 6, I love this, where the Lord said to Joshua, don't be afraid because of these people. For tomorrow about this time, I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. And over in verse 12, so all the cities of these kings and all their kings Joshua took and struck with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed them as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. And he summarizes in verse 18, Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. There was not a city, verse 19, that made peace with the children of Israel, except for the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon that we read about the last couple weeks, and all the others they took in battle. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, and they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them as the Lord had commanded Moses. Goes on and says, they killed these Anakim, these giants. And in verse 23, so Joshua took the whole land, according to all that the Lord had said to Moses, and Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel, according to their divisions, by their tribes. Then the land rested from war. That could have just been the end of the book, really, because that's pretty much what happens. But then it's like they're going, well, there were some more details that we want to throw at you. Because again, in a collectivist culture, you're really fascinated by what it took to get to that point. For us, we would go through chapter 11, okay, killed a bunch of people, got their land, and everything was at rest. But then they go, well, but here's some of the deal. So chapter 12 lists all the kings that they killed, which might seem weird, except without eliminating a king, and you know, you don't end up having security at all. And sometimes it seems cruel that kings were targeted, and we see that today as well, like in the Middle East. But if you don't take out a leader, you're not going to take out all the people that they are, you know, rallying to their support and things like that. Sometimes a whole people will flip once the leader is gone. So it lists the kings that Moses killed on the east side of the Jordan River when they were in the wilderness. And it says in verse 6, these Moses, the servant of the Lord and the children of Israel, had conquered and gave it to the possession of the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh. And then verse 7, and these are the kings of the country which Joshua and the children of Israel conquered. And it lists all those kings. So that takes you through chapter 12. Now, stay with me. We get to chapter 13. Now, Joshua was old, advanced in years. And the Lord said to him, you are old and advanced in years. Thanks a lot. I mean, I don't know if anybody feels like, yeah, I'm old and I want somebody to tell me I'm old. If I'm old, I already know it. But God's like, you're old. We're not super comfortable with that. My son Danny and Lauren and Amelia, who's 4, went to visit Ann's mom. I hope she's not listening. But and then they came to our house. And I go, oh, did you go visit Grandma? And Amelia goes, yeah, my daddy wanted to see her before she's dead. But She's in her 90s. But so here's Joshua. It's like, you've accomplished a lot. You're old. Face it. But look at this. You're old, advanced in years, and there remains very much land yet to be possessed. This is the land that yet remains. I love that God said, Joshua, you're tired. You're old. He's in his 80s. He had been through 40 years in the wilderness. He had gone through that disappointment of being a spy into the land, and he and Caleb were in agreement, we can do this, and everybody else outvoted him, so they all had to wander in the wilderness. Now they're the oldest guys in Israel. Joshua's running things. People still seem as rebellious as ever, but God's starting to do big things. And finally, he's just old. He's just tired. But I love that God said, you are old. Don't be in denial. You know, you don't need to have a bunch of surgery and make yourself not look so old. I don't need you to pretend like, oh, if you just do Tai Chi, then you're going to be ripped. It's like, no, you're old. It's okay. But you being old doesn't mean I'm done with you. I'm just getting started from what I want to do in your life. And I hope for all of us old people and you young people, someday you'll get to that point. And being old doesn't mean you're done. In fact, being old puts a little more of an alarm on you that you better keep moving. Because if you stop moving, you'll lose every capacity that you have. When you're old, you have less to lose. So really, old people should be the ones who are on the cutting edge of serving God and doing what God has called us to do. So face your age, but know that God is saying, I'm not finished with you yet. And I love that part of chapter 13. And then it goes through all the territory. Basically, in chapter 13, it goes to all these different cities, and they go to the border towns. And chapter 13 is all about securing the border of the promised land. They hadn't conquered all of the land in the middle of Israel yet, but they knew that if you don't secure your borders, you're not going to have a country. You're not going to have a land. And so he put that first and strategically said, secure the borders first, and then we'll settle everything else. There's a lesson there somewhere. And then it mentions in verse 14 and again in verse 33 that the tribes were getting some of their land on the borders, but he said the tribe of Levi didn't get any land. They will come in a later chapter, but they were specifically eliminated from this because they were the ones who were supposed to be responsible for all the worship. And so they had a special calling, but as we're going to see, God spread the Levites out so they'd be closer to all the people, not just have their own little compound, you know, to hide away in. But so that happens in chapter 14. You see this story as the tribe of Judah is getting their land, but a part of the tribe of Judah, there was land that had been promised to Caleb. Caleb was the other guy with Joshua who had voted correctly to say, we can conquer this land. And so Moses had promised Caleb, once you guys finally go into the land, you can pick the place that you want. And Caleb looked at this place up in the mountains where they had been to spy out the land, and he goes, I want that place. Well, it was a part of the overall area of Judah, but he specifically got that area. And it's kind of a cool story. It says in verse 8, children of Judah came to Joshua and Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, said, you know the word which the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. He goes, remember that day when Moses said to us, hey, you can have this, whatever land you want? He said in verse 7, I was 40 years old back then when Moses was a servant of the Lord, and he sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought back word that was in my heart. And Joshua knew about this because he was with them. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. What a legacy. I did what God told me to do, even though I was outvoted, even though they all thought I was wrong. But he said, Moses promised that day that you can have the land that you want. And so in verse 10, now behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, ever since the Lord spoke this word to Moses while Israel wandered in the wilderness, and now here I am this day, 85 years old. He goes, that happened when I was 40, I'm 85 now. And then he says, as yet, in verse 11, I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so now is my strength for war, both for going out and for coming in. Seriously? You really think at 85 you're as strong as you were when you were 40? He's, like most 85-year-olds, a little delusional, but you have to love it at the same time. It's like he's like, oh, I'm as strong as I ever was. One time, a little bit before Pastor Chuck died, we both spoke at a pastor's conference, and he spoke, and I spoke after him. And Chuck got up there, and he goes, I feel like Caleb. I'm as strong at 85 as I was when I was 40. And so people are like clapping. And so then when I got up to speak, I go, you know what I love about Chuck? He's just as delusional as Caleb was. I said, he's not as strong as he was then, but I love that he thinks he is. That's really cool. So he ends up, verse 13, Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as an inheritance. It therefore became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. God, what a testimony. What a story that over the years, he completely followed God. Now, it doesn't mean that he was perfect. He never did anything wrong. But his compass was always, okay, God, what do you have for me? What do you want me to do? He wasn't perfect, but he had a track record of saying, I was willing to go against what everyone else thought. I was willing to stay committed to something even though I was in the minority. I was willing to listen to God and to do what he said, and now he's done it, and now I find. And he had to go, still, they had to go make war up here, and there were giants, Anakim, that lived up there, and he had to take them out. But he was like, I've followed God. And that's the testimony of this book as well. The guy was old. The guy was unrealistic about his own abilities, and yet he followed God, and so God said, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to secure it for you and your family. Again, it's all about family. It wasn't like he wanted to live there. He wanted his family to be there. Later, he ended up making a deal with anybody who would marry his daughter could live there as well. But, you know, he laid that out, but his testimony was, I've completely followed after God. What a cool testimony. So then we come to chapter 15, and it says, so this was the lot of the tribe of the children of Judah, according to their families. Judah was a huge tribe, and so they had this chapter. Chapter 15 lays out all the cities, all of the places, all of the border of the tribe of Judah, the largest of the tribes. Now, in the middle of that, there's, again, the story about Caleb and having his share in verses 13, 14, 15. So he got that in the middle of the tribe of Judah, even though he wasn't of the tribe of Judah. But they lay out the borders for the tribe of Judah in chapter 15. And then in chapter 16, they began this process of, okay, where is everyone else going to go? And so they cast lots to figure out, we've got Judah situated, now where are we going to put everyone else? And so they had God cause the lot to be cast and to show, okay, you guys are going here, you guys are going here. They all fought together. It wasn't just that, okay, go take your own land. It was that we're all going to take that land for you. That's kind of important. But, you know, we see in verse 4, the children of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, took their inheritance. In verse 10, they didn't drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer, and so they had to deal with them ever since. And then in chapter 17, you have Manasseh was split in half, because half of Manasseh was going to stay out in the wilderness on the east side along with two other tribes. But here, the west side of Manasseh, they established their border in chapter 17. And it says that, you know, that in the process, the children of Joseph complained and said in verse 14, "Why have you given us only one lot and one share to inherit, since we're a great people, inasmuch as the Lord has blessed us until now?" They go, "We need more land than that." And so Joshua said, "Okay, if you are such a great people, then why don't you go up to the forest country and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and the giants, since the mountains of Ephraim are too confined for you." He's like, "You don't have to just settle for the land that I've outlined for you. You're strong. You want to get it, you want to make a winter retreat up in the mountains or whatever? You can go up there and take that land. How's that?" And they're like, "Eh." You know, all the Canaanites who dwell in the land, in verse 16, they have chariots of iron, and both those who are of Beth Shean and its towns and those who are of the valley of Jezreel. So Joshua told them, "Look, you're a great people and have great power. You shall not have only one lot, but the mountain country shall be yours. Although it is wooded, you shall cut it down, and its farthest extent shall be yours, for you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots and are strong." So they all fought to take certain things, and then they go, "But if you need a little something more, you want a mountain retreat, you can do it. God will allow you to go beyond that border, but you still have your homeland where it is." So, interesting story. You come to chapter 18, and it says, "Now, the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh. They set up the tabernacle of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them." So they all got together and said, "Now it's time to really worship the Lord, probably to do sacrifices, to be, here is our place, here's the tabernacle." The Levites could run worship from there. They had this place, Shiloh. Now later, all of that moved down to Jerusalem after Jerusalem was conquered after a while. But at this point, Shiloh was the place where, and we went there on our last trip to Israel. It's just an amazing, beautiful location. It was a good place to start and to develop. But they did it, and yet in verse 2 it says, "But there remained among the children of Israel seven tribes which had not yet received their inheritance." So Joshua said to the children of Israel, "How long will you neglect to go and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers has given you? Pick out from among you three men for each tribe, and I'm going to send them. Go get the land, survey it, and take it." And so he said, "You're not finished yet. Seven of the tribes still haven't taken their land." And he doesn't blame those seven tribes. He blames all of Israel, because, like, you guys are in this together. You need to decide to help these tribes get settled on their land, on their property, on what God has promised them. God can promise you and give you an area, but you need to be willing to go in there and actually fight for it and take it. And so he's telling them that's what you need to do there in chapter 18. And then so then it talks about that territory, and continuing in chapter 19, again, all of the people, all of the families who cast lots to take over all of this land. And then you come to, in chapter 19, beginning with verse 49, he says, "When they had made an end of dividing the land as an inheritance, according to their borders, everything was mapped out, the children of Israel gave an inheritance among them to Joshua, the son of Nun." He's old. He's about done. He's still doing what he can do. But they're like, "We need to take care of our OG. We need to take care of our guy who has got us here." It also tells us something about Joshua as a leader. The last thing he was even thinking of is, "Where's my place?" But the children of Israel noticed, "You've helped us. Now, we want to bless you, and you need to have your spot as well. Not for Joshua, he's old, he's not going to be around that much longer, but he does it so that they'll have a place so that his family, his roots can sink in, and they'll be there. And so it says that, you know, they had finished dividing the land. According to the word of the Lord, verse 50, they gave him the city which he asked for, Timnath-Serah, in the mountains of Ephraim, and he built the city and dwelt in it. Verse 51, these were the inheritances which Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel, divided as an inheritance in Shiloh before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle. So they made an end of dividing the country. The end of chapter 19. Now, another appendix, chapter 20, gets added in because remember before, as they're going through the land, he said several times, the Levites, the tribe of Levi, didn't get a section of land. Well, now in chapter 20, he explains the Levites got little cities throughout the entire nation. They're supposed to be spread out. They're the ones that are the ones who bring people to God, the ones who help people worship God, and they didn't need to have their own little place off by themselves. For one thing, they tended to, probably Levites weren't the best warriors anyway, but beyond that, they needed to be with the people. And so chapter 20 lays out all of the, all of the places where they went. He said, appoint for yourselves in verse 2, cities of refuge, first of all. So actually, before the Levites, he goes, there's also going to be these cities of refuge. It was a place where he explains, like, let's say some guy accidentally kills someone. Well, that guy's family, because they're collectivist, they're going to kill you. It doesn't matter whether you killed them on purpose or not. You know, maybe you guys were just, you know, got tangled up, something bad happened. But they made these cities throughout the nation that were cities of refuge to show that there was a place for grace. There was a place to protect people who somebody else might want to kill them, but there wasn't sufficient evidence to convict them of a crime. And so I love that in chapter 20 that you see him going, you set these places apart. Now, they weren't, it describes, okay, somebody kills somebody accidentally. But all these cities of refuge, they couldn't have accidentally killed that many people. So there were probably people who were accused of stuff, but there's not enough evidence. And he's like, I just don't want, you know, you to run wild and be making decisions that cost other people their lives when they haven't really had a fair trial, haven't really had a fair hearing. So if you feel like you're in over your head, you can go to a city of refuge and nobody gets in trouble there. It was an interesting place for grace in the whole thing, which I think was a pretty cool thing that gets tacked in here before then talking about the Levites having their place. And so in verse 3 of chapter 21, the children of Israel gave to the Levites from their inheritance at the commandment of the Lord these cities and their common lands, and it lays them out. So everyone, once they got their land, they all contributed to supporting the ministers, the Levites, who would then be among them, who would be connected with them. And so it lays out all the specifics, but you know, it's really an important thing that they took care of them. But like Joshua, kind of took care of them at the end. They didn't put them first. They all said, man, we need them to intercede for us before the Lord. And so, yeah, we want them to be here. And then if you go to chapter 21, you didn't think I could get through it, huh? I'm not going to get through 22. Justin can have that for next week because it's a long chapter, but and it has a lot of cool stuff in it. I hope you come back. Trust me, we don't do this every time. You're like, I feel like you're just summarizing the Bible for me. Okay. You should appreciate it a lot more than if we took a week on each of these chapters. Trust me. We're not collectivists. So, verse 43. So the Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers. And they took possession of it, and they lived in it, they dwelt in it. The Lord gave them rest all around according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand, and this is the point, not a word, verse 45, not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. Amazing. That what all of these words, all of these names, all of these locations, all of these dead kings, it all came about because God is saying, I'm going to do what I need to do to fulfill my promises to you. And so he did it, and it worked. And again, it may not be, the details may not be fascinating to us, but we should really appreciate at the very least, the bottom line is that God's going to do what he promises to do. Now, there are lessons in this passage for all of us, I think, and applications that we can take from it. One of the things I think that's important for us to consider is that, you know, even though this may be kind of confusing to us, you get the basic message. It's important for you to have a home location. It's important for you to have a place where you're grounded, where you establish roots. Now, our country is made up primarily of people whose roots are somewhere else, and they immigrate here, but then at some point, you have to go, this is my place. Now, I'm guilty sometimes of teasing people who decide, I don't want to live in California anymore, I'm afraid of Governor Newsom, and so then they run off to these podunk places. But, you know, the Lord's really convicted me that I need to encourage them. For one thing, a bunch of them still listen to our church and they get mad at me when I say that. But also beyond that, it's important to find whatever place it is that you feel like this is where I want to sink in my roots. This is where I belong. This is home to me. And again, because that's what I feel in Orange County, it doesn't mean somebody else has to feel it in Orange County. It's okay to leave one place, go to another place, but we should all find a place where we go, this is home for me. And it may change through your life, but we should be careful not to just give up on the notion that it matters where you live. Now, again, people can look at, well, but things change, they're not the way they used to be or whatever. And we can also say, well, you know, this world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. But this is God showing that, yes, you can say that your real home is in heaven, but you have to also understand it's important. Lots and lots of people had to die so these people could find a place where they would plant roots. And you need to find a place where you can do that. Now, the other thing that you see in these stories is that it takes a group to help. Not everyone immediately finds their place. This is a team effort. We should, if there's anyone among us that hasn't found their place, we should all be involved helping them find their place. Not helping them just force themselves into a preconceived notion, but we should be looking for how can we see that everyone among us ultimately has found a place that feels like home. Yes, temporary, but it matters to God. It did then, it does now. And so I think to look for that and to realize that if one of our brothers and sisters hasn't found that,